We've been talking about the lack of scientific evidence for the support of self-esteem. In other words, that there's no evidence that it does what its advocates say that it does, enable people to function more effectively. John Leo, in a U.S. News and World Report article, states the case even more categorically than those cited earlier. Quote, the core assumption in the self-esteem movement is that children cannot learn or develop properly unless they form a positive self-image. But no study has ever demonstrated a connection between feeling good about oneself and improved performance. End of quote. It's fascinating to observe the tenacity of the belief in self-esteem in the face of research to the contrary. John Leo observes, quote, the self-esteem movement is one of the marvels of our time. It goes on and on, even though its assumptions are wrong and its basic premises have been discredited by a great deal of research. Like a monster in the last 10 minutes of a horror movie, it has enough fatal wounds to stop a platoon, but it keeps stumbling on, seeming not to notice. End of quote. Here we find another indicator of the emotional attachment of self-esteem that we talked about earlier. Regarding self-esteem, Iowa State University psychologist Brad Bushman concludes, quote, no one wants to admit it doesn't do any good. End of quote. Thus, we continue to embrace this deadly virus, even though its impact makes us increasingly weaker. The apparent reason for its survival is that the theory is too comfortable and too compatible with the existential philosophy of our society to give it up. Self-esteem has been one of the most prominent expressions of personality theory within the evangelical community. Therefore, continued unwarranted belief in this concept supports continued misplaced trust in personality theory. In other words, as we continue to believe in self-esteem, this enhances, this encourages our belief in personality theory. However, if evangelicals understood the unscientific nature of the teaching of self-esteem, it may open their eyes to the larger danger, the unscientific and destructive nature of personality theory in general. Next, I want to look at an anecdotal examination of the Rogerian approach. Perhaps the best measure of the validity of Roger's theory resides in his own attempt to apply this theory on a large scale within an educational system. This experiment took place in the context of a Catholic school system in California. The school system, operated by the Sisters of the Immaculate Heart of Mary, IHM, was made up of 60 schools, including a college. The order at the outset of the project consisted of 560 nuns. William Coulson, a colleague of Rogers for many years, was the project coordinator and has reported on this project. Though anecdotal, I believe this experiment provides a good test for the effectiveness of Rogers' theory for a number of reasons. It was conducted by Rogers himself. If anyone should have been able to make the theory work, he should have been the person. It comes at a time when Rogers' theory had opportunity to mature. The project began in 1966 when Rogers was about 64 years old, perhaps at the prime of his career. He had been doing therapy for about 35 years, had taught for 23 years, and had published perhaps his most significant work, entitled On Becoming a Person, A Therapist's View of Psychotherapy, 5 years earlier. So that by this time, his ideas and skills in applying them were well seasoned. This project, this research, is also significant because it applied Rogers' ideas on a large scale in various settings, such as group, individual, and an organization as a whole. If it were a small study, one might conclude that some quirk might have influenced its outcome. But its magnitude provides a fair opportunity for the application of Rogers' theory. Another significant reason why this project provides a good measure for of the effectiveness of Rogers' theory is that it is Rogers' major effort to apply his theory to an entire population. In other words, this was his big experiment. One last reason for its significance is that its results were so dramatic. As we will see, it's not just a matter of succeeding or failing just a little bit, a few percentage points. Beginning in 1966, the Sisters of the Immaculate Heart of Mary allowed Rogers, Coulson, and 58 facilitators to operate in counter groups within the school system. In other words, Rogers moved in with a big cadre of people. Administrators, teachers, and students participated. The function of these groups was to provide a non-threatening Rogerian environment of unconditional acceptance that would encourage the participants to be aware of and express their feelings. That is, to experience non-directive self-exploration. In a later publication, Rogers speaks of, quote, an exploration of increasingly strange and unknown and dangerous feelings in oneself. This exploration proving possible only because the individual gradually realized that he is accepted unconditionally. In other words, through the application of Rogerian approaches, the people involved felt themselves unconditionally accepted and therefore were free to get in touch with and express their feelings. Apparently, this was the type of feeling Rogers wanted the participants to experience. These groups were designed to produce a sense of freedom from the authority of establishment institutions, ethical systems, and even one's own rational dictates, and to generate the corresponding freedom to pursue the direction indicated by one's feelings, which is the natural outcome of unconditional acceptance. In other words, Rogers wanted to see these people guided by their self-actualizing tendency, and this would occur if they would experience unconditional acceptance. So that's what the project was designed to provide. The results of this project were dramatic, both in the direction they took and in their magnitude. The short-term results looked quite positive. Coulson recalls, quote, Rogers and I did a tape for Bell and Howe, who were the project sponsors, summarizing the project. I talked about some of the short-term effects and said that when people do what they deeply wanted to do, it isn't immoral. In other words, the initial response was behavior that, according to Coulson, seemed to be acceptable. As these people were unable to do their own thing, when they began being guided by their subjective instincts, their self-actualizing tendency, initial indications were that they behaved appropriately. That is, over the short haul. However, Coulson reflects, quote, we hadn't waited long enough, end quote. Soon the picture changed dramatically. Coulson reports that within a year, 300 of the 560 nuns, quote, were petitioning Rome to get out of their vows. They did not want to be under anyone's authority except the authority of their imperial inner selves, end quote. Coulson cites, quote, a tragic book called Lesbian Nuns Breaking Silence, which documents part of our effects on the IHM and other orders that engaged in similar experiments, end of quote. The book recounts lesbian activity among nuns resulting from the influence of these groups. Coulson reflects, quote, an older nun in the group, freeing herself to be more expressive of who she really was internally, decided that she wanted to make love with Sister Mary Benjamin. Well, Sister Mary Benjamin engaged in this, and then she was stricken with guilt and wondered, to quote from the book, was I doing something wrong? Was I doing something terrible? I talked with the priest. Coulson explains, unfortunately, we talked to the priest first. And then the Sister Mary Benjamin goes on to say, I talked to the priest who refused to pass judgment on my actions. He said it was up to me to decide if they were right or wrong. He opened the door, and I walked through the door, realizing I was on my own, end of quote. Coulson also speaks of, quote, seduction in psychotherapy, which became virtually routine in California, end quote. Let me say parenthetically that I'm giving all of these direct quotes because I want you to get the flavor of what Coulson is saying here. Coulson goes on talking about the seduction of psychotherapy by attributing it to the fact that, quote, we trained people who didn't have Rogers' innate discipline from his own fundamentalist Protestant background, people who thought that being themselves meant unleashing libido, end quote. And Rogers came from quite a conservative background. And so he restrained himself from doing a lot of the things that the people that he trained ended up doing. Coulson makes a valuable observation here. A population can survive the imposition of unconditional acceptance for a while if it has a historical commitment to a strong ethic. That commitment will temporarily prevent these people from indulging in promiscuity legitimized by unconditional acceptance. In other words, if one teaches unconditional acceptance to a group of people who have a strong ethic, they will intuitively realize that unconditional acceptance does not legitimize unethical behavior. But given time, that ethic wears off and unethical behavior begins to show itself. This temporary result provides the false impression that unconditional acceptance does not lead to licentiousness. But in the absence of such an ethical commitment, or when it wears off, the true impact of unconditional acceptance quickly comes to the fore. Where ethical commitment exists, promiscuity takes a while longer to reveal itself. But eventually, unconditional acceptance erodes the old ethical structure. This is essentially the process that has taken place in the United States across the past three decades. And we see it happening here with the IHM community. They had a strong ethical basis to start with, but the teaching on unconditional acceptance eroded that base. Coulson cites a book entitled Hollywood Priest, which describes how one of the nuns from IHM order, quote, got into the spirit of Rogerian non-directive encounter, end quote, and propositioned a priest. Therapists were assigned to nuns who opened up too much in the encounter groups. When the priest refused, the nun became sexually involved with her Rogerian therapist. Coulson reports, quote, he got her involved in sex games in therapy. Rogers didn't get people involved in sex games, but he couldn't prevent his followers from doing it because all he could say was, well, I don't do that. Then his followers would say, well, of course you don't do that because you grew up in an earlier era. But we do, and it's marvelous. You have set us free to be ourselves and not carbon copies of you, end quote. In other words, these therapists asserted the right given them by Rogers to be accepted regardless of their behavior and to accept themselves regardless of their behavior. Consequently, Rogers had no grounds for opposing those who exercised these rights. This development and Coulson's analysis of it are significant in that they demonstrate graphically that unconditional acceptance really does grant the individual autonomy, the right to do his thing, whatever that may be. Here we find therapists becoming sexually involved with clients who are nuns. In the practice of psychology, sexual involvement with a client is viewed as a dual relationship, that is, a relationship with a client in addition to the therapeutic one. Dual relationships are viewed to be highly unethical, sometimes leading to the loss of licensure for a psychologist. Therefore, in addition to the promiscuous nature of this behavior, it included a serious breach of professional ethics. Beyond that, the nuns involved were breaking their vows. This was not only problematic because of the personal ethical default of these nuns, but also because it was undermining the structure of the organization that was hosting this experiment. Consequently, it constituted a breach of business ethics. In other words, these psychologists were really undermining the organization who had hired them on, and that was a breach of business ethics. The point is that despite the multitude of ethical violations represented by this behavior, unconditional acceptance granted these therapists the right to practice it, eliminating any basis for condemning it. It is of special note that the only difference between this behavior and that of the hippie is that it was carried out by professional people rather than college students and condoned by a recognized psychological theory rather than merely the assertion of the hippie that he had a right to do his own thing. And the point here is just this, that Rogerian psychology and the teaching of unconditional acceptance really brings us to the same existential worldview and the lifestyle condoned by it as the existentialism of the hippie. The ultimate result of Rogers' project was the closing of all but one of the schools. In other words, of the 60 schools involved, all but one, including the college, was closed. Of the 560 nuns, Coulson estimates that there may be only a couple of dozen remaining. Coulson recalls, quote, "We called off the study after 2 years because we were alarmed about the results. We thought we could make IHM better than they were, and we destroyed them," end of quote. Rogers himself was troubled with the results. Coulson taped an interview with Rogers in 1976 in which Rogers shared his feelings about the project. Quote, and this is a quote from the taped interview, from Rogers. "I left there feeling, well, I started this thing, and look where it is taking us. I don't even know where it's taking me. I don't have any idea what's going to happen next. And I woke up the next morning feeling so depressed that I could hardly stand it. And then I realized what was wrong. Yes, I started this thing, and now look where it's carrying us. Where is this going to carry us? And did I start something that is in some fundamental way mistaken and will lead us off into paths that we will regret?" End of quote. This was not the only project that misfired for Rogers. Coulson reports that 5 additional educational projects were unsuccessful. Apparently, ultimately, even Rogers developed doubts about his theory. Toward the end of his life, speaking to the Association of Humanistic Psychology, Rogers lamented, and I quote, "I hope Rogerian therapy goes down the drain. Yes, you can try to grow to be more often empathic and more often feel an unconditional regard for this person, but it is not something you should do," end of quote. Rogers hoped that Rogerian therapy would go down the drain has gone unrealized. Rather, his ideas represent one of the most dominant forces, perhaps the most dominant force, in contemporary secular society and also among evangelicals. Let's look then at the macroscopic impact of Rogers' theory on our society. The IHM study provides us with a microscopic view of what has been happening in the United States at a macroscopic level since the 60s. In other words, just as the IHM adopted Rogers' concepts and the results were as described above, so our society as a whole has adopted these concepts with similar results, including the right to be self-directed, the rejection of institutional authority and ethical codes, and the resulting sexual promiscuity. I believe the ultimate test of the Rogerian approach has been this macroscopic impact on our society. It reveals that the unconditionally accepted person, and the person who in response accepts himself unconditionally, has unconditional self-esteem, does not act lovingly, but instead he acts selfishly. It exposes Rogerianism as a colossal failure. It's common knowledge that our society has been in a cultural and moral slump since the 1960s. The breakup of the family, school shootings, teenage suicide, educational decline, drug and alcohol abuse, the acceptance and exaltation of homosexuality, abortion, and the bankrupt and vulgar entertainment media are just some of the symptoms. Though it is difficult to hold psychology responsible exclusively for this cultural moral decline, it is also practically impossible to extricate psychotherapy from liability for a substantial portion of the responsibility. Several factors link psychotherapy with this decline. The first link is found in the relationship between the message of the most prominent personality theories and the nature of our societal decline. Let me just mention a few. The victim mentality propagated by psychology has become a prominent aspect of our culture. This development is recorded by Charles J. Sykes in his book, Nation of Victims, The Decay of American Character. This view of oneself as victim discourages people from taking responsibility for their actions and exercising personal discipline in their behavior. The heavy sexual emphasis found in personality theories such as Freudian psychology has also been a moral detriment. Also leading to moral decline is the existential and morally relativistic orientation of the Rogerian theory. And this theory, as we've seen, makes the individual the only authority for what is right for him. Likewise, the feelings orientation of this internal guidance system encourages people to view their lusts as appropriate guides for their lives, and to set aside spiritual and rational considerations that might inhibit these illicit desires. The advocacy of non-performance-based self-esteem assures the individual that he's okay regardless of how he lives, thus militating against the work of the conscience, allowing him to practice selfishness with impunity. The behavioristic view of the human being as an animal provides justification for practices such as abortion and euthanasia, since behaviorism places no unique value on the human being. Therefore, we find strong ties between these theories, the strong theoretical ties between these theories and the moral deterioration of our society. A second link between societal decline and personality theories is found in the timing. Numerous charts that trace the downward plummeting of our society in various areas indicate that the distinct downturn began in the mid-60s, and the decline worsened from that point. It is precisely at this point in our history that psychology began to exercise substantial influence, being adopted as something of a secular religion. Since that time, it has continued to grow in prominence and power. This leads to a third link between cultural freefall and psychotherapy. Since the 60s, psychology has not only become one force among others in our society, but it has virtually saturated our national psyche. Its principles have become guiding lights in our secular worldview, shaping our approach to life and our ethical perspective. The concepts contained in the major personality theories described earlier have been assigned the status of truths to live by, saturating our views on how to conduct our personal lives and relationships, education, the function of government agencies having to do with the family, and the orientation of society as a whole. One of the most disturbing factors related to recent history is that the evangelical community, rather than becoming a bulwark to stand against societal decay, has participated in it. A divorce rate among evangelicals as high as that of the secular community, and in some studies even higher, graphically illustrates our participation in the recent societal decline. At least one of the studies has revealed explicitly that the high proportion of divorced people among evangelicals has not resulted from bringing those who have been divorced into the church. In other words, we don't have a high divorce rate because we've reached a lot of divorced people, and therefore we have a lot of people who have come in from the outside who are already divorced. Rather, the overwhelming majority of evangelicals who are divorced were divorced while they were evangelicals, after becoming evangelicals. Evangelical moral decline is also reflected in many other factors. To what do we attribute this decline? An examination of the evangelical community indicates that in most areas, we are practicing historic evangelical practices. We are teaching the word, attempting to evangelize, seeking to advance global outreach, maintaining schools, printing huge quantities of literature, and propagating our views through radio and television. In other words, we seem to be doing all of the right things, all of the things that we've traditionally done as evangelicals. Why then the change? Why the decline? With the availability of all these avenues of spiritual growth, why do evangelicals reflect the moral and spiritual decline of the surrounding secular culture? It is reasonable to assign responsibility for this decline to the factor constituting the most dramatic change that has taken place in the church across the past several decades. In other words, we have to ask, well, what has changed? And what has changed is the infiltration, propagation, and influence of psychology, especially personality theory, within the evangelical community. The influx and propagation of psychological concepts and the incorporation of these ideas into the very fabric of evangelical thinking and living represents the major modification of the evangelical community across the past several decades. a modification that corresponds temporally with its decline. In other words, when we started accepting psychology, that's when the evangelical decline began. Though, as with secular culture, I am not suggesting that we lay all of the responsibility at the feet of psychology. However, since there can be no doubt that psychology has become a dominant force, if not the dominant force, in the evangelical community since the 1970s, psychology cannot enjoy dominance without taking responsibility. If psychology is going to be a major player, then psychology must take responsibility for what is happening. It is instructive to note that the decline has taken place in the areas where psychology specializes, for example, marriage and family. Our point in underscoring the relationship between societal decline, both secular and evangelical, and psychotherapy is to give yet another evidence of the failure of psychotherapy and the related personality theories to help people, but instead their propensity to do harm. Though in one sense, this macroscopic demonstration of the influence of personality theories, the negative influence, if you will, may be unscientific, perhaps in another sense it represents the most compelling evidence for the failure of psychotherapy and personality theory. In light of the dominant role played by psychotherapy and personality theory in both the secular and evangelical communities across the past several decades, the emotional, behavioral, and relational welfare of these communities must, to a great extent, be a reflection of the impact of psychotherapeutic ideas. In other words, these ideas have saturated our communities. Therefore, what has happened in those communities must be a reflection of these ideas and their impact. We can only conclude that the impact on both communities has been destructive. In this lesson, we have examined personality theories looking at scientific evidence. We looked at anecdotal evidence, specifically the work of Rogers at the Immaculate Heart of Mary Schools. And we've also considered the impact of personality theories on society as a whole. In every case, we have seen that personality theories, rather than being helpful, have produced a negative impact. I end this lesson as I started it by asserting that the fault for the negative impact of these personality theories is not with the psychotherapists, but with the therapies. Now, we saw a little bit ago that some of those psychotherapists misbehave, and of course that is their responsibility. But looking at the overall picture and the fact that people have been hurt, the primary problem is not with the therapist, but with the therapies. And I believe this is especially true in the evangelical community. I believe that most evangelical psychologists and other evangelical counselors that propagate these personality theories are really caring and well-meaning people. Nothing said in this lesson or in this course is intended in any way as a personal assault on them. However, we cannot ignore the reality that the ideas that they are propagating are ineffective and even detrimental. Even though in this lesson we have seen that these personality theories are not supported by science, then they are not effective, but rather we see that they're counterproductive. As evangelicals, the ultimate analysis of personality theories must be done by utilizing Scripture, by examining them from the perspective of Scripture. Therefore, our next lesson has as its objective the examination of these personality theories from a scriptural perspective. This is the end of 7th.